better than I remembered her face. I closed my eyes, and I remembered her standing in my dark hospital room. I remember her asking me a series of questions to measure my cognition after brain surgery. "You kept asking me questions," I said as I stepped away from her again. "Yes," she said. "And you just kept telling stories and jokes, so many jokes. You woke up from surgery and started talking and wouldn't stop. It was amazing. We'd never had a brain surgery patient come out so lucid. You were so funny. We couldn't believe how funny you were." I remembered only bits and pieces of that time. I choked back tears. "I must have been scared," I said. "I am funnier when I'm scared." She hugged me this time. And then I stepped away from her for the third or fourth or fifth time. Why was I so shy? I think it was because my nurse and I had shared a physical intimacy that went far beyond sex. After brain surgery, it was her touch that brought me back into the world. Her touch gave me back my body. Her touch reintroduced me to the corporeal. Her touch began the healing process. "Thank you," I said. "Thank you for taking care of me." She smiled. I wanted to thank her for being maternal, for being that compassionate woman at my bedside, for bringing me the magic and medicine. But I worried about how Oedipal and way Indian that would sound. So I repeated myself, hoping the repetition itself would somehow let her know how important she was to me. "Thank you," I said. "Thank you for your kindness. Thank you for your kindness. Thank you." She said, "Please keep writing your stories, and I will keep reading them." I said, "I will remember your face now. I will be able to place you more fully in my memories now. I won't feel so fragmented now." I hugged her one more time, and then I had to say goodbye. I hurried away with my wife and friends. 10 minutes later, walking to my car, my back spasmed so hard that I almost fell to the pavement. I cried out in pain and leaned against my wife and a friend to remain standing. "Are you okay?" my wife asked. "Yes," I said. "I thought you were having a seizure," she said. "No," I said. "The world is too fucking big. Sometimes I can't even carry myself through all the love and fear." With my wife holding my arm, I limped toward the car. I coached myself. I said, "Sherman, you can make it through this pain. You can always find your way through any pain." And, with my wife's help, always, with my wife's strength, I made it into the car. I was in great pain, but I took the time to write down these very words. "This is who I am. This is who I have always been. I am in pain. I am always in pain. But I always find my way to the story. And I always find my way home." Chapter 105. Therapy. 1. Today, for you, I will remember 6 of the worst things that have happened to me. Give me a high five for my honesty. Okay, I've decided to go with the 4 worst things. Maybe 3 would be better. I know it's only the 2 of us in this room, but I'm an Indian, so it always feels like my entire tribe is crushing into this or any room with me. Maybe I should tell you 1 bad thing. And nothing too bad, either. I have to be careful. Other Indians are eavesdropping. 2. In therapy, 1 hour equals 50 minutes. an early memory. When I was 2, I'd comfort myself by rubbing my face against my big sister's pantyhose. No, she wasn't wearing the hose at the time. If that were true, it would bring up a whole different conversation. Okay, sometimes I rubbed my face against my sister's pantyhose while she was wearing them. So yes, I have, as they say, issues. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. I have 4 surviving siblings. My big sister died in a house fire. I often write about her death. Sometimes I think I should stop. But why should I stop grieving in poems if I can't stop grieving in life? Fire. 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 You know, something like 70% of the country is awake at 6 a.m. I get up at 6 a.m. and I'm ruined for the rest of the day. 6 a.m. What is up with that? 3. Okay, here are the 6 worst things that have happened to me. 1. Comic book swap. 2. Butter knives. 3. Saint Ignatius. 4. Blank. 5. Lungs. 6. Top 10 toys. You'll notice that I listed only 5 things. I left one blank to account for the blank spots in my memory, for the sour relief of repression. You'll also notice that my list is vaguely metaphorical or metaphorically vague. You didn't really think I was going to give away everything, did you? This is a confessional poem, not a church confessional. Hail Mary, full of grace. 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 When I was 3, my big sister ran away and became a teenage mother. By the way, my big sister's name was Mary. There's a photograph of Mary and me playing dueling grand pianos. Did you really believe that a reservation Indian family would have even 1 grand piano? And if there is a reservation Indian family out there who does have a grand piano, then please email me a photograph care of Shock to Shit, Seattle, Washington. 4. Parked outside my therapist's office, I watched another therapist attempt to parallel park. When you grow up on a rural reservation, you only have to park parallel to the earth. So I was impressed that she parked skillfully in a very narrow space. But I guess it wasn't quite parallel enough. So she pulled out of the space and tried again. And again. I thought she parked well, but she thought otherwise. She parked, pulled out, parked, pulled out, parked, and pulled out for at least 10 minutes. Finally, she parked in a way that pleased her, or maybe she just abandoned the effort. But as she stepped out of her car and walked toward her office, I thought, damn, I want that one to be my therapist. 2 pills every day. The side effects are, well, interesting. 3 of the side effects. The urge to write prose poems. Self-consciousness. Night sweats. I wake 4 times a night, drenched in sweat, sheets soaked, pillow like a life preserver in Lake Sad Ass. Awake at 5 a.m., a full hour before most of the country, I pretend that I'm the only Indian who has survived genocide. It feels strangely familiar. I realize that every Indian often feels like he or she is the only Indian who has survived. Today, As I walked around downtown Seattle, I studied strangers' faces and wondered what six most horrible things had happened to each of them. 5. These are six worst things that have happened to people I know. Filmed while being gang-raped by a group of men wearing paper bags for masks. Lost 4 sons in 4 separate car wrecks. Lost mother to heart attack and then, during her funeral, lost father to heart attack. Contracted AIDS while having sex for the first time. Lost husband and 3 sons in the same plane wreck. Lost mother to cancer and daughter to house fire in the same month. Is there a cure for grief? 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 Be funny. Be funny. Be funny. Be funny. Humor is a crutch. Humor is a crutch. Humor is a crutch. Who are the 2 funniest human beings who have ever lived? Richard Pryor, before he caught himself on fire while freebasing cocaine, and Richard Pryor, after he caught himself on fire while freebasing cocaine. One flame. 6. One more flame. People always said that Big Sister and I could have been twins. I'm lying. My sister and I looked nothing alike, and she was born 13 years before me. My other sisters, twins, are only 1 year younger than me. You could call us Irish triplets if we happen to be Irish. It's cute, but frankly, I prefer to be symbiotically connected with my dead sibling. The 4th word of the Bible, King James Version, is God. The 4th word of the Bible, New American Version, is when. When, God, 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 when. When I was 6 years old, I had an epileptic seizure while playing King of the Hill on a woodpile, collapsed, rolled down the logs, and landed on the grass. I don't know what happened to my sister when she was 6. I barely know anything about my sister's life, but I do know at least 6 things about her death. Chapter 106. How does my highly indigenous family relate to my literary fame? Home on the reservation, back from his colonoscopy in Spokane, my big brother texted me. Dad used to say he knew you were famous when he found your books at Goodwill. But I say you're famous when the ass nurse is asking me how I like having a famous brother. Chapter 107. Will the big Seattle earthquake trigger a tsunami the size of God? I have placed a big canoe on the roof. Inside that boat, water, rope, airtight food, first aid kit, waterproof clothes, blankets, boots, fire starters, and my mother's ghost. To access the roof from inside our home, tall and narrow, there's a ladder in the hall closet near the bathroom on the 3rd floor. It's a collapsible ladder hung on the door. To break the window glass, plaster, and joists, I've got a hammer with steel points. And my mother's ghost. She'll protect my eyes from every sharp and falling surprise. I thought of purchasing a real gun or a weapon that only gassed or stunned, but didn't want that danger in my house, no matter how useful. My mother's ghost, armed with over 5 centuries of grief, will repel post-disaster assholes and thieves. Dear family and friends, dear blood, dear you, I will paddle in the night to your rescue. Look for me. I'll be in the endless boat, illuminated by my mother's ghost. Chapter 108. How are you? I'm honored by your concern. I would like to gather all of the books that contain the words mother and grief, set them aflame, and dance as they burn. I'm sleeping okay. 5 or 6 hours at night, then 2 naps during the day. I want to sledgehammer every truck in a 10-block radius, push them into the lake, and build a reef that will be named Mother Grief on the map. I'm overeating, but I always eat too much. So I think I'm overeating at my usual pace. Study my face. I've always looked more like my father, but this morning, I woke to see my mother in the mirror. Grief is a plastic surgeon. I'm not hiding from the world. I've seen my psychiatrist 3 times in 3 weeks. I remembered to put gas in my car. There's an undiscovered animal perched in that big tree in our backyard. It glows, has bluish claws and feathers, and sings old evangelical hymns. All my neighbors have tattooed my mother's name on their wrists. I twisted my ankle while cooking brown rice and chicken with habanero pepper. But I think clumsiness is normal at a time like this. My left eyelid twitches. But that's just stress. I bought a telescope to distract myself by studying stars and discovered a new constellation. It's near Orion, and it resembles a native mother cradling her son. Chapter 109, Where the Creek Becomes River. I have not worn a pair of moccasins in 4 decades. Let me repeat that. I have not worn a pair of moccasins in 4 decades. Let those 11 words become a chorus. I have not worn a pair of moccasins in 4 decades. The last time I wore moccasins was in Arley, Montana, on the Flathead Indian Reservation during the 4th of July powwow in 1976. Is there any greater oxymoron than bicentennial powwow? A few days earlier, my father had ran away from home on yet another multi-day drinking binge. And my mother, as she often did in reaction to my father's escape act, had also impulsively run away from home. But she, as usual, took my little sisters and me along with her as she drove from our reservation across the Idaho and Montana borders into Arley. In the indigenous world, we assign sacred value to circles. But sometimes, a circle just means you keep returning to the same shit again and again. This book is a series of circles, sacred and profane. As a teen, my mother had been married to a man who lived in Arley, but I didn't know about that marriage in 1976. Looking back, I suppose she took us to Arley in some effort to reclaim her youth, or perhaps to reclaim a certain part of her youth, her sexuality. Shortly after dropping my little sisters and me at the campsite of my aunt and cousins, my mother climbed into an RV with a man, a stranger to me, and drove away. I can't recall any physical details about the man. I don't know if he was Indian or white or something else. I only remember waving goodbye and crying as that man and my mother drove away on a dirt road. I remember all the dust kicked up by that RV's wheels. Even now, my throat constricts with that memory of dirt and tears. By the silt of abandonment. My aunt, in an act of consolation, gave me a new pair of moccasins. She had originally bought them to give to one of her sons as a gift, but she was desperate to stop my weeping. So she gave those moccasins to me instead. She knew I might cry for hours. She was probably scared I would rage and wail until my mother returned, and who knew when that would be. My little sisters were sad too, but they were powwow dancers. So they consoled themselves by wrapping shawls around their shoulders, like indigenous armor, and dancing in a collective circle with all of the other powwow dancers. But I didn't dance. My childhood brain surgery and years of after effects and seizures and medications and hospital stays and subsequent illnesses had left me a physical and emotionally frail kid. I didn't have confidence in my body or soul. I didn't feel strong and graceful enough to dance. I didn't feel like I deserved to dance. I didn't feel Indian enough to dance. But wow, looking at those new moccasins made me feel like a super Indian. They were deer skin with a thick sole and were lightly beaded, just a few rows of beads, yellow, blue, and red, forming the outline of a five-pointed star. I still wasn't courageous enough to dance, but I pulled on those moccasins and ran through the powwow grounds. Soon enough, I saw a group of other Indian kids running and laughing, so I ran with them. That's what kids do. In my memory, the Arley powwow grounds was bordered on one side by a creek. Looking at Google Maps, it appears that creek is farther away from the grounds than I remember. But I would swear that some Indian folks were camped almost next to that creek. I could easily fact-check this geography by emailing my friends who live on that reservation. But emotionally speaking, it feels more accurate to think of that creek as being a part of the powwow grounds rather than flowing a football field distance away. I ran with those Indian kids to that creek, which was shallow and flowing fast. That creek was perhaps 5 feet wide, and I remember running back and forth across a pedestrian bridge. A bridge across a creek? If my memory is true, then that creek must have been a popular destination. I remember those other Indian kids kicking off their sneakers and socks and splashing into the creek. It was only 2 feet deep. But I didn't know how to swim. And so I was afraid. But then bravely and irrationally, I pulled off my new moccasins, set them on that little bridge, and stepped into the water. The water was so cold that I gasped. Looking again at Google Maps, it appears that creek flows into the Jocko River, so that might account for the speed of the current. The other Indian kids, stronger and more graceful than me, ran with and against the current. But I could only carefully and clumsily walk with the current. I remember the feel of the slippery rocks on the creek bottom. If my memory is correct, then that creek must have been flowing fast for many years in order to smooth those rocks. It was a very hot day, so the water felt good. And I splashed the cold water at the other Indian kids as they splashed water at me. We laughed. It wasn't easy for me to make friends. But I thought these kids, who were non-dancers like me, might become my friends for the rest of the powwow and help me forget my loneliness. And then I heard a commotion behind me, a different kind of laughter. And I turned around to see an older Indian kid pick up my new moccasins from the bridge and drop them into the creek. I don't remember if I said anything, if I cursed or shouted, but I distinctly remember those moccasins floating and flowing down that fast creek toward me. More than that, I remember that 8 or 10 or 12 Indian kids stood still in the water and watched my moccasins pass by. And then it was just me, unsteady in the current, as I crouched like a soccer goalie and tried to intercept my moccasins. I reached for them and missed. And then I dove after them as they floated away, but I missed again. I was briefly submerged in the shallow creek, and when I got back to my feet, I watched my moccasins disappear around the bend, and then, presumably, flow into the Jocko River. I know this is a sad story. In the context of a different and better and calmer childhood, this sad story might not even be all that sad. It might be worth a sigh or two. But this sad story has mythic power for me. In fact, this story is so painful for me that I almost didn't include it in this book. Indeed, I added this chapter at the last possible moment before publication. I vividly remember watching my new moccasins disappear. But I don't remember stepping out of that creek. I don't remember walking back to my aunt's campsite. I can only recall stepping into the teepee and telling my aunt that I had lost my moccasins. And then she slapped me hard across the face. I was stunned. My father had never practiced any form of corporal punishment on me. And my mother had at that point only physically assaulted me once. And yes, she'd used a thick twig to spank my butt, but she'd punished me that severely because I had forced my little sisters to smoke cigarettes until they vomited. And while I'd been slapped, punched, and kicked by other kids, I had never been struck by an adult. And then my aunt slapped me again. I fell to the ground in a fetal ball as she continued to slap my head, arms, legs, and back. She slapped me at least a dozen times. I would have many bruises. She screamed at me for losing my moccasins. She reminded me again and again that she had bought them for her son and not for me. She called me an idiot. She called me a loser. And then I rolled away from her, ducked under the edge of the teepee, and made my escape. I didn't return to my aunt's campsite that night. I walked the powwow, barefoot and alone, for hours, until the sun went down, until the last powwow song ended, until the food stands closed, until even the last drunk had passed out. I was 9 years old. I was angry and afraid. But I wasn't going back to my aunt's campsite. I refused to surrender, to concede, to seek her shelter. I don't remember if I slept that night. I do remember that an old Indian woman gave me a piece of fry bread the next morning. She took pity on me, I guess. I give thanks to her. And then I walked around the powwow all that next day and again into the night until I heard my mother call out to me. She had returned to the powwow. I remember she was carrying my shoes. I remember that I fell asleep in the back seat of our car as she drove us back to our reservation. I don't remember arriving home. When my father returned home from that particular drinking binge, he had shaved his hair into a mohawk. I was embarrassed for him, embarrassed for me, embarrassed for every Indian in the world. I look like a warrior now, he said to me. No, you don't, I said. As I finished the first draft of this chapter, I smelled ozone, a common olfactory hallucination that happens to epileptics. I also tasted mud and tears. Silt. I thought of my mother carrying my shoes. I thought of my father removing his cowboy hat to reveal that mohawk hair. A few years after I lost my new moccasins, my sister died in St. Ignatius, Montana, less than 20 miles away from the bridge across the creek. Ozone. 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 I didn't have a seizure while writing this chapter, but I smelled ozone. I smelled the dank water of that creek flowing away from me. And I tasted blood in my mouth. Over the last 4 decades, I have visited my friends and family on the Flathead Indian Reservation, but I have never again stepped foot on the R. Lee powwow grounds. And I have not worn a pair of moccasins in 4 decades. Chapter 110. Kind. After being psychologically and physically tortured by our missionary teachers, by all of those cruel white women and men, and after finding little solace at home from our native parents and grandparents who'd been tortured in the same way, we Indian kids are hungry for any tenderness from anybody. We fall in love too easily. We get pregnant too young. We run away with strangers. Then we run away with other strangers. Or we fall in love with the same boy or girl who was tortured alongside us. We spend our lives with the person who has the same scars in the same places. We make love with the person whose open wounds snap into ours like Lego pieces. And then, of course, we rage at our neediness. We might turn racist and sexist and homophobic, turning against those people as powerless or more powerless than us. We hate power. We hate weakness. We hate all white people. Or we fall in love with all white people. Or we fall in love with the white liberals who want to heal us. Or we fall in love with the white conservatives who want to hurt us again. We reenact the racist torture and salvation in our beds. We cry in the arms of white people. We cry in the arms of other Indians. We boast and brag. We insist our damage is greater than all of the damage suffered by all of the other damaged people. We are the gold medalist in the Genocide Olympics, or maybe just the silver medalist, or maybe we just win the bronze because Custer was only 25% as bad as Hitler. In response to our generational pain, we Indian kids become addicted to torture. To the memory of torture. Or wait, no, maybe we are addicted to gentleness, to gentle white people. Hello, my name is Sherman, and I am addicted to white people. Or maybe, after centuries of being tortured by white civilization, I am addicted to those white folks who will reward me for being Indian. I am addicted to those white folks who will not torture me. Does any of this sound like love? Chapter 111. Tribalism. A non-Native friend said, Native Americans were the victims of genocide, so why isn't there a museum of the Native American genocide? And I said, because we Indians would spend years arguing about whose tribe suffered the worst massacre. I have visited museums of genocide in other countries, though I realize visited is the wrong verb. Endured is too self-serving. Perhaps the best sentence is, I have experienced museums of genocide in other countries. And what do I remember? I remember that I kept having to close my eyes against the pain. I often had to look away from the pain. I often had to sit on benches and stare at the blank floors. And what do I make of the Genocide Museum in our own country? What do I make of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum? It is a vital place. It is a grievous reminder, a warning. It is as necessary as any museum ever built. But it also proves to me how the United States closes its eyes against the pain it has caused. The United States often looks away from the pain it has caused. The United States often sits on benches and stares at the blank floors. So if ever built, what will the United States Native American Genocide Memorial Museum contain? What will it exhibit? It will be one room, a 50-foot square with the same large photo filling the walls, ceiling, and floor. There will only be one visitor allowed at any one time. There will be no furniture. That one visitor will have to stand or sit on the floor, or lie on the floor if they feel the need. That visitor must remain in that room for 1 hour. There will be no music. The only soundtrack will be random gunshots from rifles used throughout American history. Reverberation. What will that one photo be? It will be an Indian baby, shredded by a Gatling gun, lying dead and bloody in the snow. It is a photo taken by a U.S. cavalry soldier in the 19th century. Very few people have seen that photo. I have not seen that photo. But I know it exists. The Smithsonian keeps such photos locked away from us. The United States wants all of us to forget the crimes it committed against the indigenous. The United States wants us to forget. The United States wants us to forget. The United States wants us to forget. A non-Native friend said, "Native Americans were the victims of genocide. So why isn't there a museum of the Native American genocide?" And I said, because we Indians would spend years arguing about whose tribes suffered the worst massacre. Chapter 112, Security Clearance. After I'd agreed to teach a writing workshop in a women's prison, I received an application in the mail that asked me to list the names of any relatives or close associates who have served or are currently serving time in correctional facilities anywhere in the world. I thought of my father and brother and uncles and reservation friends and cousins who'd been inmates. Then I called an official number. I was transferred, put on hold, ignored, interrogated, dismissed, and finally, I was helped. So, I'm supposed to list all of the people I know or are related to who have been in jail or prison? I asked the friendly clerk. Yes, he said. Even the ones I haven't seen in years or decades? Well, it's safer to answer as completely as possible. What if they're dead? Put them down and write deceased by their names. Okay, I said. You're sure I need to put all of them? That's what I advise, he said. And what kind of crimes are we talking about here? Murder an attempted murder, I said, rape, child rape, assault, robbery, drug possession and drug dealing, domestic violence, forgery, failure to appear in court, failure to pay criminal fines, contempt of court, theft, public intoxication, driving while intoxicated. Wow, the clerk said. Have you ever been convicted of a crime? 2 speeding tickets, I said. One in 1989 and one in 2008. That's it? Yeah, I'm the rebel of the family. I again looked down at the small space where I was supposed to supply the required information about my convict family. You know, I said, there's not enough room on the application to list everybody. You can put them on a separate sheet, he said, and attach it to the application. Are you sure it's okay to do that? I asked. You wouldn't be the first, he said. Some people have attached 2 additional pages. Wow, I said and laughed. Then I said my goodbyes and, as a long distance and complete non-participant in a 1-page indigenous criminal clan, I listed all of those felons who share at least some of my genetics. It took me approximately an hour. Chapter 113, Ode to Gray. Has anybody written an ode to Gray? Well, if not, then let me be the first. Let me praise the charcoal pit, tweed suit, and cloudy x-ray that reveals, to your amateur dismay, nothing you understand. Who has been amazed enough to write a breathy love song to Gray and Gray's nearly imperceptible interplay with other Grays? Oh, how beautiful the haze of charcoal pits, tweed suits, and cloudy x-rays of airport luggage. I love the dog day, the long delay, the existential malaise. Has anybody written an ode to Gray? If not, then let me proceed without delay. Oh, let me construct an army made of clay. Marching, marching, they will be my ode to Gray, to charcoal pit, tweed suit, and cloudy x-ray. Chapter 114, Tyrannosaurus Rez. Yes, I've survived all of the genocidal shit that killed so many in my tribe. And it is absurd that I've made a great career out of nouns and verbs. But look, it's a miracle when any writer sells even one damn book. So listen to me. I was conceived with 20,000 years of my ancestors' stories locked in my gray matter and flooding my marrow. So don't think I'm flattered with your homily about how I must be some kind of anomaly. I am my mother's son. I am my father's child, and they left me a trust fund of words, words, and words that exist in me like dinosaurs live in birds. Chapter 115, Objectify. Desire is the inconvenience of its object. Lords isn't lords if you live in lords. Don Patterson. Best thought, worst thought. How often have I walked through my front door and forgotten to exult? Why won't I roar for all of the objects that I adore? When did I stop praising the books I hoard and the bookcases lovingly restored? Why do I ignore the baskets and gourds, O Lord? Let my love for things be reborn. Let me sanctify my hand drums, adorned with feather, paint, and bead. Let me drum for the star quilts piled on the beds and floors. I own so much, yet want for so much more. Why do I greet the sacred with my scorn? From this day forward, let us be forewarned. Lords isn't lords if you live in lords. Chapter 116. My Mother as Wolf. Reintroduced into the wilderness, my mother struggles to remember what her wolf ancestors knew in their DNA. And here, just as this poem begins, I have to tell you that when that first stanza originally popped into my head, I dropped into a fugue state that had me flying through the universe while dodging planets and suns. This flying through the universe thing had previously happened only when I tried to meditate. Whether guided by teachers or during some half-assed attempts of my own, I'd never been able to calm myself and empty my mind. Instead, moments into any attempts to meditate, I'd fly with light speed through the endless dark. I'd be awed by the beauty of the universe and terrified by the isolation. Some friends tell me that I might have been in a meditative state anyway. I don't believe it, because I'd fly for only a minute or two before I'd fall asleep. So I think I might have been disassociating instead of meditating. Maybe I'm too terrified to let go of this terrifying world. Maybe I'm just sleep deprived. I often get sleepy during moments of stress. I could fall asleep during a gunfight. Sounds like disassociating, right? And it seems to me that disassociating is the opposite of meditating. Reintroduced into the wilderness, my mother struggles to remember what her wolf ancestors knew in their DNA. When this first stanza arrived in my head, I was sitting next to my wife, watching a married couple reenacting an argument. On stage, the woman recounted how she, as an 8-year-old, contracted polio from a bad sugar cube immunization. She speculated that she was one of only 3 people in the United States who caught polio from inoculate because her immune system was already burned out from the case of mumps that her physician father didn't care to notice. My father was a great healer, she said, for everybody except his own children. At that very moment, I thought of my late mother as a wolf, and of her immense and intimidating and feral power. And then I disassociated and launched into my flight across the universe. My mother, pack-hungry, lopes through the tall wild grass in search of other wolves and other mothers. So yes, I did end up writing a second stanza about my mother as a wolf, even after that first stanza disassociated me. But here's the crazy thing. After that woman on stage talked about her polio, and after I disassociated, fallen asleep for a few minutes sitting in my chair and was awakened by audience applause, I turned to my wife and smiled. I was going to joke about falling asleep, but my wife said, "Why'd you leave?" I was confused. "I've been sitting here the whole time," I said. "But you got up and left," my wife said. "You bumped my shoulder, and then you were gone. and I didn't even realize you'd come back until you smiled at me. I laughed and told her about my flight through the universe and quick nap, and she said, childhood trauma can give you superpowers, right? My mother stalks a small pack of sheep. She knows these animals are protected by humans with rifles, with metal and fire. My mother doesn't have a word for rifle, but she knows 100 ways to say hungry and blood and tooth. And yes, she taught me those words. So watch me now as I rend, gnash, and chew. Chapter 117, All My Relations. I am related, by blood and marriage, to men who hit women, and to men and women who hit children, and to men and women in jail, and in prison, and on parole, for stealing and robbing and raping and shooting and stabbing and punching and kicking and forging and abetting and neglecting and manslaughtering and murdering and dealing and buying and muling and abandoning and vandalizing and breaking and entering and jacking and driving without insurance and driving under the influence and driving without a license and vehicular homiciding and shoplifting and deserting and violating and failing to pay on time and failing to pay at all and failing to yield and failing to stop and failing and failing and failing and failing. So many felonies and misdemeanors. Therefore, I have been at parties, weddings, births, barbecues, tailgaters, games, proms, funerals, baptisms, and graduations with convicts and ex-convicts whom I love and whom I hate, and whom I have met only once and hope to never see again. I have been victimized by some of those criminals. I have been the subject and object of their misdemeanors and felonies. Scholars talk about the endless cycle of poverty and racism and classism and crime. But I don't see it as a cycle, as a circle. I see it as a locked room filled with the people who share my DNA. This room has recently been set afire, and there's only one escape hatch, 10 feet off the ground. And I know I have to build a ladder out of the bones of my fallen family in order to climb to safety. Chapter 118, How to Argue with a Colonialist. Sherman, says Mr. Blanc, I am sorry that you interior Salish Indians lost your wild salmon to the Grand Coulee Dam. But honestly, can't you do your religious ceremonies and cultural stuff with wild salmon from elsewhere? Or with salmon you farm yourself? Yes, I say to Mr. Blanc. Many of us interior Salish Indians do order wild salmon at restaurants. We definitely eat and enjoy wild salmon caught in rivers not our own. And yes, we also farm our own salmon as well. But honestly, Mr. Blanc, comparing outsider and farm salmon to our own wild salmon is like comparing bobblehead Jesus to the real Jesus. One is plastic, and the other one is blood. Chapter 119. Dear Native Critics, Dear Native Detractors, I write about this shit because this shit happened to me. Did shit like this happen to you? Did this shit happen to some Indian you love, some Indian you know, some Indian you knew? this shit happened to me. This shit happened to Indians I love. This shit happened to Indians I hate. This shit happened. 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 Now, let's pick up a hand drum and sing it together. This shit happened, way ah, yeah. 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 This shit happened to me, way ah, yeah. This shit happened to you, way ah, yeah. This shit happened to Indians I love and hate, way ah, way ah, way ah, ho. This shit happened. This shit happens. This shit is happening now. But if this shit didn't happen to you, dear Indian, if this shit never happened to you, then I am happy for you. I am happy for you, ay-ya-ha-ya. I am happy for you. If this shit didn't happen to you, then I feel joy for you. I feel joy for you. I feel joy for you, ay-ya-ha-ya, so much joy for you. But dear Indian, if this shit didn't happen to you, then why do you need to judge the shit that happened to other Indians? Why do you, like a school teacher, hand out grades to the shit that happened to us? Why do you shame 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 us for the shit that was done to us? Why do you shame us, the already shamed, who sing our poems and tell our stories because we want to be unashamed? I am the Indian trying to be unashamed, way ah, hi-ya. I want to be unashamed, way ah, hi-ya. I am a child of the sun, way ah, hi-ya. And there is nothing that can clean you like the sun, way ah, hi-ya. I expose my shame to the sun, way ah, hi-ya. I illuminate my shame, way ah, hi-ya. I want my shame to burn, way ah, hi-ya, to burn, way ah, hi-ya, to burn away, burn away, burn away. And maybe, maybe, as I sing, maybe, maybe, I can teach other Indians, the clan of the ashamed, to leave that clan and start anew. Let us leave the clan of the ashamed and start anew. Let us leave the clan of the ashamed and start anew. Let us leave the clan of the ashamed and start anew. Let us leave the clan of the ashamed and start anew. Dear native critic, dear native detractor, do you judge me because I want to be new? Do you judge me because I am not the same kind of Indian as you? Chapter 120, Slight. In Seattle, a street magician fucks up. He's publicly performing a year too early. A little girl shouts, "I can see your fake thumb." I hurry away from his embarrassment. As I recall, When I've gone public too early with intimations and declarations of love. Who hasn't been crushed by embarrassment? I gave an awkward eulogy at my mother's funeral. It certainly wasn't a declaration of love. I delivered half jokes, half truths, and half apologies.